From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Santa Clara.
Santa Cruz.
Union City.
Hayward.
San Francisco.
I'm from Fremont.
Yo, I'm San Jose, just downtown.
Coming up on this special edition of Cross Currents, we're taking a look at wrongful convictions. On today's show, we'll explain why witnesses to a crime are so unreliable.
That's what makes it scary, because often the witness will be 100% sure. It's just that their perception is incorrect.
We'll also hear about one man's quest to prove his innocence after being convicted of murder.
I was writing to all these places to get, you know, somebody to hear me, that I'm in prison for a crime I didn't do.
And we'll look at the growing movement to free thousands of innocent prisoners.
There was no organization whose job it was to screen such cases and then advance them.
That's coming up on Cross Currents. Today we're looking at what happens to people when they're accused of a crime they didn't commit, and how our institutions are set up to deal with the wrongfully accused. Our first story takes us to the police station, and right into the middle of a police lineup. Shows like CSI have taught us that a lot can be gleaned from clues left at the crime scene, and painstakingly pieced together by investigators.
See, once it dried, the pattern revealed itself. You see this discoloration right here?
Looks like the tread from a boot.
What I initially thought was a V is actually a W.
And that's the logo for Woodridge Hunting Boots.
Yes, it is.
What they don't often show is how fallible evidence can actually be if it's not properly obtained. More and more, prosecutors and police are coming to question the ways in which they've typically done business. KALW's Charlie Mintz delved into a nationwide effort to reform police lineups.
A murder happens, like this one reported on by the Modesto News. Police arrive at the scene, but the shooters are long gone. How they figure out who done it often comes down to one thing, a witness.
We are asking if there are any witnesses that are out there that may have been driving by, may have saw anything suspicious related to this business. Please call the Modesto Police Department.
What did the car look like?
Yeah, it was a little dark-colored compact car, four-door.
Multiple shots, maybe one and then a series of other shots. Did you hear anything like that?
No, I didn't hear anything like that, but one of my kids said that they heard something like that.
The driver is said to be Hispanic, in his 20s, bald and wearing a multicolored hooded sweatshirt. The accomplice is white and was last seen wearing a black bandana and blue jeans. If you have any information, you're asked to call the Manchester Police Department.
It's intuitive. If you want to know what happened, who committed a crime, ask someone who witnessed it.
Well, a lot of people think that eyewitness identification is the most accurate. The reality is very different.
That's Jeff Adachi,
the San Francisco public defender.
And he's handled thousands of criminal cases.
And I have to say that probably one of the most common sources of error that I've seen is misidentification.
Research backs that up. A 2004 analysis by San Francisco Magazine looked at 200 wrongfully convicted people. Of those 200, more than half, 60%, were the victims of misidentification.
Why is that? Because we're human beings, and human beings and the human eye is fallible.
What science is learning about memory helps explain why the eye can lie. The old way to think about memory treated it like a picture stored in your brain. We now know that isn't true. Memories are actively created. Remembering an event is more like painting a picture than looking at a photograph.
That's what makes it scary, because often a witness will be 100% sure. It's just that their perception is incorrect.
A crime scene could be dark, a witness's adrenaline high, and a witness may only get a fleeting glimpse of the suspect. All these factors, experts call them estimator variables, will make it harder to recall what the perpetrator looked like. But perception is only half the story.
When you talk about how a person is identified, often there are suggestive procedures that are institutionalized.
These suggestive procedures play out in the interactions between officers and eyewitnesses. They can be subtle or not so subtle.
I've seen cases where the officer who is administering the lineup has a clear bias, and that comes off clearly. I mean, we've seen TV shows where, you know, the officer coughs or, you know, does something to indicate who the suspect is. And yes, that does happen sometime in real life.
Obviously, you don't want police officers telling witnesses who to pick. But the much deeper problem is when officers unconsciously indicate who the witness should choose. This can happen in all sorts of ways, from the way an officer asks a question to the officer's body language. These behaviors are the system variables, and they are the target of a nationwide effort to reform police lineups.
There are a small number of errors that happen in criminal cases.
Jeff Rosen is the district attorney for Santa Clara County.
And the question for me as the DA is, well, how should I think about those errors? Is it like being struck by lightning, or is it like an airplane crash?
Getting struck by lightning, Rosen says, is just an accident. A plane crash is probably preventable. Likewise, a misidentification is largely preventable if the system does its job right. In the lineup, the police can control for these errors. In 1999, the Department of Justice released recommendations for police lineups to improve them. There were two main suggestions. The first was that the officer conducting the lineup not know who the suspect is. This is called double-blind administration, and it's how a lot of scientific research is done. What it does is prevent the officer from subtly guiding the witness to choose the person the officer knows is the suspect. The second recommendation is sequential lineups. This means that the witness is shown potential suspects one at a time instead of all at once. This forces the witness to be sure of his or her choice and not just choose the closest match.
This was not that difficult to get our police chiefs in the county to agree to.
Santa Clara County adopted the new procedures in 2002. Sequential lineups and double-blind administration became standard throughout the county. Recently, the county has also added video recording of witnesses to improve reliability.
So essentially what we've done is we have slightly fewer positive identifications, but they're much stronger.
Despite this success, California cities have been slow to adopt the new protocol. San Francisco did so last year. Across the Bay, Alameda County still hasn't done so. A recent study found only 8% of police departments in the state are in compliance with Department of Justice recommendations, though the number is growing.
There's always some resistance to change, particularly when something has been done the same way for a long period of time. And the within the district attorney's office, you know, there were certainly prosecutors that just, do we really need to make this change? What does it matter?
In Sacramento, lawmakers have tried several times to pass bills mandating improved lineup protocol. Each time, the bills have failed. Police departments say the procedure is more expensive. Reformers disagree. The real issue, they say, is inertia. The way things have been is the way they tend to stay. Those pushing for reform say that change will come when police departments and district attorneys get on board. Though the process is slow, signs are that may be happening. Until then, we might do well to be a bit more skeptical of what we think we've seen. For Cross Currents, I'm Charlie Mintz.
For more information on the effort to reform the criminal justice system, check out our website. It's klw.org. That's where you can hear all of our stories, find more local news, and subscribe to our podcast. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. We've all heard stories of people who end up in prison, even for years, because of what's called a wrongful conviction. The Northern California Innocence Project has helped exonerate 13 people so far. The average amount of time an exonerated prisoner has spent behind bars is more than 13 years. Mistaken identities, mishandled evidence, and misconduct are a few ways wrongful convictions happen. Every system has flaws, but the stakes are especially high in criminal justice. An error can mean the difference between sending a guilty or innocent person to prison. San Francisco resident Maurice Caldwell was a low-level drug dealer living in Bernal Heights when he found out just how devastating a relatively simple blunder can be. KLW's Julia Lundberg has that story.
Let's go back in time about 20 years. It's the early 90s. Young people are watching MTV, their parents' Twin Peaks. Maurice Caldwell is 22 years old and lives in the Almany Projects in Bernal Heights, on the same street where he grew up. He works in an industrial warehouse in Hayward and likes to hang out with his friends.
We went places, did things, go to the movies, go horseback riding, go fishing, go bowling, play ball.
But Caldwell is the first to say he was a troublemaker.
I wasn't a choir boy. I wasn't, you know, no angel. I sold drugs, you know. I did that, you know, time to time.
And from time to time, he'd come in contact with police.
I used to get arrested like two or three times a month, you know. So it was nothing new to me, you know, because I was like, there's nothing, you know. They just want to, you know, question me and let me go.
Until in the morning hours, one day in September of 1990, when Caldwell was picked up and taken to the county jail at 850 Bryant Street. That day, police accused him of murder.
It was a shock. It was a complete shock. I felt like, oh, y'all tripping. Y'all making a mistake. You know what I'm saying? You really don't know your job if you're trying to accuse me of murder. You're not doing your job.
What did they say?
That's what they said. You had a right to remain silent. You was under arrest. That's what they say.
On June 30 of 1990, on the 900 block of Ellsworth Street in the Almeny Projects, a man named Judy Acosta was murdered outside a car. Police found one woman who witnessed the killing as she stood at her apartment window. When police first questioned her, she told them that the shooters do not live around here, and she didn't know their nicknames. 2 weeks later, police returned with a picture of the woman's neighbor, Maurice Caldwell. According to what was later presented at trial, the woman identified Caldwell as the shooter and said she'd seen him standing under a streetlight when Acosta was shot. Whether the streetlight is even visible from the woman's window became a big question, but not until years later. At the trial, no one questioned her testimony, and Caldwell was disappointed with his lawyer.
I had a so-called lawyer, but he was ineffective, totally. He didn't do nothing to, you know, help me fight my case.
The prosecutor, Al Giannini, was an assistant district attorney in San Francisco at the time. He says it's not surprising the witness changed her story, nor did he hide that fact at trial.
I'd like to remind you, the jury actually heard those tapes. And I think they accepted the fact that she was saying a couple of different things. I think it's just the sort of apparent inconsistency that happens when people describe things. But if you talk to them a little bit, they clear it up, and it's clear that they mean the same thing.
Giannini believes Mary Cobbs, the witness, was telling the truth.
It is my personal opinion that Mary Cobb was an entirely credible witness, and certainly the jury accepted it, and she was very compelling.
Caldwell's trial for first-degree murder proceeded quickly. What would usually be a year's worth of preparation was condensed into 6 months.
They didn't take their time and do the work that needed to be done, you know, in order to show that it's an innocent man incarcerated. You know, they just wanted to go on my character and look at bad at character, and that's all what was go lead to the conviction. And that's what happened. When they were saying guilty, I thought they were saying not guilty. You know, I really thought justice prevailed, and then I looked at my lawyer and my family and them, and they were shaking their head like, it didn't dawn on me they were saying guilty.
2 weeks after the trial ended, the 23-year-old Maurice Caldwell was locked up at San Quentin State Prison.
I had 27 years to life. When they say to life, that can mean your entire life. From when they first put the handcuff on me, I was thinking of a way to get up out of this. You know, what can I say? What can I do?
And unlike other inmates who hung out in the yard, made acquaintances, and started to build a life for themselves in prison, Caldwell became a self-styled student of the law.
Because the comfortability in prison, or relax in prison, that means, you know, you're doing everything in there. You want to be a part of everything. You know, they got games, sports. You know, they got bingo night. You're a part of all that. They got job, trades. They got work programs. I didn't want none of that. You know, all I wanted to do was deal with the law.
Caldwell wrote letters to attorneys all over the country, always saying the same thing.
I was writing to all these places to get, you know, somebody to hear me, that I'm in prison for a crime I didn't do, and it's going many days, years, you know, but I continue.
And after 17 years in prison, he finally got an answer from Paige Koenig, a lawyer with the California Innocence Project.
I got a box of files on his case in January of 2008.
Koenig went through thousands of pages of trial transcripts and scrutinized all the facts surrounding the one witness who testified.
She went from saying, they don't live around here and I don't know their nicknames, to it's Tuan who lived next door to me. I immediately was like, all right, this is, you know, this is clearly a problem.
So Caneb had a list of dozens of people who had lived in the area and might have seen something. She searched for them one by one and eventually found one person who had been out there that night almost 20 years earlier and who could help her find two other witnesses.
For both of them, it was the first time they'd ever seen anyone shot and killed, so this stood out as something in their minds, and both of them told us who the two real shooters were.
Caneb says, unlike the police, she was careful about influencing the witnesses' memories.
I interviewed them separately. They hadn't spoken to each other. None of them have spoken to Maurice or the guy who confessed, who's now in prison for another murder. I kept thinking that at some point someone was going to care about who really did this, you know, who really killed this guy. And it was just like they didn't care at all.
The whole process of overturning Caldwell's conviction took more than 3 years.
And Maurice's mom was sick during a lot of this time. And he was really, really patient throughout everything. But he would tell me sometimes, you know, I'd just like to be able to get out in time to take care of my mom.
While Caldwell's mother got sicker and sicker, the legal system sputtered and stalled.
And she died during the year of delays of the DA's office.
Caldwell did get out. A judge found that Caldwell's defense attorney had been incompetent and overturned his conviction. While Caldwell and Caneb believe justice has been served, Giannini's disappointed with the outcome.
These things, they happen. It's unfortunate that you can have a case that goes all the way through the system, and the police did nothing wrong, the prosecution did nothing wrong, the jurors did nothing wrong, and the witnesses all told the truth. And yet, because of something that has, you know, nothing to do with guilt or innocence, a murder conviction is overturned years and years after the fact when it can't be retried. It's just something that happens. We all have to live with it.
On March 28, 2011, Caldwell walked out of custody and met up with his sister and his lawyers. His first destination, McDonald's. On a cold November day, we're parked in Maurice Caldwell's blue Corolla. Now he lives in the East Bay and hardly ever comes back to San Francisco since he got out of prison nearly a year ago.
March 28, 2011. Yep, that's my day. Me walking out of 850 Bryant with my jail paperwork and some county clothes that they gave me with a big old smile on my face. That's what that is.
How would you like it to have been?
Most of all, me hugging my mom and my grandmother. That's the most thing I would have wanted out of anything in life, to be able to hug my mother and my grandmother and tell her I told you. For them to be able to see me come home now and know that everything I was telling them, That would mean more to me than anything, you know, and I don't got that.
Caldwell is not a rarity. He's just one of hundreds of former inmates whose conviction have been overturned after spending years in prison. He's hoping to sue the state and get compensation for the time he served. In San Francisco, I'm Julia Lundberg for Cross Currents.
Are mistakes in the criminal justice system preventable or inevitable? You can share your thoughts at our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. That number again is 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Much like Maurice Caldwell, whose story you just heard, prisoners fighting to overturn a wrongful conviction often turn to the same place for help, the Innocence Project. Nationwide, the Innocence Project has helped exonerate 289 prisoners using DNA evidence. In the Bay Area, the Northern California Innocence Project works out of the law school at Santa Clara University. KALW's criminal justice editor Rena Palta recently visited the office for a sit-down with legal director Linda Starr.
So just to start out, tell me a little bit about the Innocence Project and how it started.
Well, we started in 2001 in response to word that there was going to be legislation passed that was going to permit post-conviction DNA testing. And we got involved in sort of helping craft that legislation and then realized that there needed to be something in place to help inmates access that kind of post-conviction DNA testing. So we started as a law school clinical program here at Santa Clara University that year, 2001.
So what are the most common issues you see in these cases? Is it usually a an eyewitness who was wrong about who they saw, or is it a procedural thing where prosecutors disregarded evidence, or what are the most common reasons you find for wrongful convictions?
Often we see a combination of factors. So we'll see something like a witness gets it wrong. One of the reasons they get it wrong is that the police maybe fudged a lineup procedure or subtly and maybe even accidentally influenced how the identification was made. And then prosecutors failed to turn over some of that evidence that would have demonstrated how that eyewitness identification wasn't done appropriately.
So why does that happen? Like, why do police fudge lineups, or why do prosecutors sort of put things, little inconsistencies, out of their minds? Is it just a case of being overworked, or is it, you know, this person's been convicted of other stuff and I'm sure we're getting them for something that they could have done, you know, that kind of thing? How does this happen?
Well, I think for police, sometimes there is that where there's smoke, there's fire. And if they didn't do this, they did something else, so let's just get them kind of mentality. But I'm going to give them a little more credit than that in some cases. I think that many times they think they have the right person, and they're afraid of losing the right person unless they somehow kind of support the identification in some way. And I think overwhelmingly there is this tendency. It's a human tendency. It's not just law enforcement that has it, but the human tendency of tunnel vision. They have a version of the story that makes sense to them, that demonstrates something to them, and they just fail to recognize the importance of something that's inconsistent with that version.
So one of the, I guess, strangest phenomena in wrongful convictions to me is the false confession, just people confessing to something that they haven't done. And I was wondering if you had any insight into why that ever happens.
That is a really interesting one. And for many of us that have been involved in the criminal justice system, that was one of the hardest ones to sort of wrap our heads around. Why would somebody admit to having done something so terrible if they hadn't done it? And there has been a fair amount of sociological research on that. And it turns out that some of what have been considered false confessions never really were confessions to begin with. They were suppositions. So say, for example, somebody is arrested and they are believed to have been the perpetrators of some horrible homicide. And they said, I didn't do it. And then they are asked, did you ever drink? Well, yes, I drank. Do you ever drink to blackout? Yes, I have. I've had blackouts before. So isn't it possible that you blacked out and committed this? Well, I guess it's possible I did that. Then that becomes a confession.
So let's talk about Maurice Caldwell specifically and his case. You guys helped him prove that he had a mistrial, I guess, and he eventually did get out of prison. Has he been able to get any financial compensation for the time he spent there?
He has not yet sought any financial compensation, but I do believe he's entitled to some. In order to be entitled to some under the statutory scheme, he's going to have to be able to demonstrate that he's factually innocent.
So you say that you've identified the actual perpetrators of this murder that Maurice was at first convicted for. Has there been any effort on the part of law enforcement or the DA's office in San Francisco to pursue who you say are the true murderers?
Not that I know of, and that has been actually an astonishing fact for me. We have one of the actual participants who actually confessed to having done it. It described in great detail how he participated, actually drew a diagram of the scene and who stood where, which exactly matched the victim's description, the surviving victim's description of the incident. And interestingly enough, did not correspond with the supposed eyewitness's identification description of the incident. And we gave all contact information and any information we had about any of these participants to law enforcement. And as far as we know, not a single effort has been made to apprehend the actual perpetrators of that homicide, including an admitted confession from a perpetrator who, after having been named as a perpetrator in this offense, law enforcement made no effort to apprehend him. He went ahead and killed another person, and he is currently incarcerated in Nevada for having shot and killed a taxi driver there. So I don't understand law enforcement's abdication of their responsibility here.
Linda Starr is the legal director of the Northern California Innocence Project. She spoke with KLW's Rena Palta. The San Francisco District Attorney's Office did not respond to repeated requests for comment. Al Giannini, who prosecuted Maurice Caldwell's case, says he's familiar with the Innocence Project's claims, but he believes Caldwell was one of the shooters in the killing of Judy Acosta. In this special edition of Cross Currents, we've been talking about the criminal justice system and what happens when it sends the wrong person to prison. We welcome your comments and stories at our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. Or you can get in touch via our website. It's klw.org. That's also where you can hear all of our stories and subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Hana Baba, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, RTM's Konohoffs, Audrey Dilling, Casey Miner, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, Joaquin Palomino, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Katie Steyer. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks especially to you. KLW is listener-supported radio. The music you're hearing is by Robin Yukiko of San Francisco. She'll be playing this Thursday night at the Hotel Utah in San Francisco. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.